Welcome back to Discursion Podcast, where we discuss all manner of films on home media, and they don't have to be new films. They can be you know, classics or more obscure films, older films that have been re-released on home media. But the idea, as ever, is to kind of rewatch these in more detail, hopefully, and to produce new thought. But yeah, maybe we can work towards that.
Get under the skin of the cinematic experience.
Yeah, using the modern technologies at our disposal.
Pause and rewind.
Yeah. Today's episode is episode 18, and it is about Infernal Affairs, which is a 2002 Hong Kong film. Broadly speaking, in the kind of action genre, but it's about a triad and a kind of double identity and identity swapping in Hong Kong, and kind of broadly in the context, I suppose, of, you know, Hong Kong's handover to China in the 90s. This is released just a few years after that, although, you know, the declaration had been signed in the 80s, so that it was kind of in consciousness, I suppose, while the film was being produced and conceived. But also starring some big actors, Andy Lau and Tony Leung. A lot of the kind of interest in this film comes from sort of tense dialogue and kind of cityscapes, and there is some kind of gun wielding and that kind of thing. But when I say action film, I don't mean, like, you know, a contemporary sort of, yeah, what's that franchise, Dominic, with this, John Wick? Yeah, I don't mean John Wick.
John Wick.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's my impression of Keanu Reeves on being interviewed about that film, where he seems to have take particular pleasure in saying the name of his character.
Yeah, there's less of that.
Yeah, although, I mean, one could absolutely, aside from the fact that they're both extremely handsome, but actually look extremely different, you wouldn't need to have any background information on Hong Kong cinema to be clear that these are two big stars, right? They're sort of, it's, if you've seen any films before, it's entirely obvious that you've got two star performances rubbing up against one another, and, you know, and the whole logic of the film that it has to come to the point when they finally meet, and, you know, it holds that off until really quite a long, well, it sort of teases you, you know, they almost meet about halfway through, but
yeah,
it's very clear, isn't it, that that's the sort of logic that it's working with, or no, not logic, but, you know, the kind of the sort of viewer engagement is, we've got these two guys together in one film. And I think that somehow comes across, even if you've actually never seen them in any other films before, and obviously would only be intensified if you had.
Yeah, it's akin to, I suppose, you know, other kind of standoff type movies like Heat and that kind of thing, where you've got, yeah, two big stars in a rivalry, and they, yeah, exchange barbed words, and the plot,
I mean, I don't have any evidence to this, but I'm assuming Heat is a explicit, in, I mean, a, what's the word? You know, a direct influence.
Yes,
I think it must have been.
Yes, and that, I suppose that's worth mentioning as well. The just the prominence of action cinema globally in the 90s too. Mm. So yeah, there's definitely a dialogue between kind of Hong Kong and Hollywood, I think, with these action movies, including, you know, the Matrix being influenced by, you know, Kung Fu and that kind of, you know, the Hong Kong directors of the day.
Absolutely.
Working on them, you know, yeah. So, yeah, there's an interesting dialogue. I was just thinking about how to describe this plot without kind of ruining the, I suppose it's, you know, we don't avoid spoilers, but
Well, one of the things, I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that is really neat about the film is how it's both quite twisty and complicated, but also actually relatively easy to follow. at least if you don't always worry about the minutiae, you know, there are bits where one might get confused about exactly what's going on or who knows what's going on, but the basic premise that you have a triad gang who've sent a number of people, but specifically Andy Lau's character, to infiltrate the police force, and you've got the police force who've sent Tony Leung to infiltrate the triad, so you know, so the good guys and the bad guys both have a mole, is actually sort of pleasingly simple.
Yes, the complexity is that, I suppose it's the moral complexity, isn't it, more than the story is, you know, even down to its style, equally weighted often in terms of these two figureheads, you know, from the opening montage, you know, cutting between these two characters, and later on the way it's staged and the way close-ups, you know, share the frame. It's more about the complexity, I suppose, comes from more about what is it to be good, and the character development is more of a complex thing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about sort of things, having mentioned Heat, but you know, things that are sort of further in the background. I mean, I suppose it's the idea of basically parallels between the goodies and the baddies, you know, or seeing both of them as institutions, which have their parallel. I mean, that goes back, you know, at least as far as, you know, Fritz Lang's M, and then sort of shortly after this, it's obviously a main feature of The Wire, you know. But perhaps, would you say, though, what you were just saying about the moral ambiguities, I think actually perhaps the film is less interested in the institutional aspects than it is in the personal aspect. It maybe looks like it's a bit more sort of procedural than it really is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? You know, its main interest, isn't it, is in the psychology of these two characters, but the kind of framing background are these two parallel institutional sort of systems, but it's not really sort of penetrating or exploring the sense in which, you know, in which the police and the triads are or are not similar to one another. That's more just the sort of groundwork that gets things moving, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think it's more about the individuals involved. In other films about organised crime, there might be more of a kind of almost like a fetishization of the various, you know, rituals and customs of a historic gang. There isn't really that kind of broader picture of who's in the family, and we do get you know, some little character portraits, but I think that it's less interested in kind of systemic failings than it is that question that we can all relate to some extent, even if we're not like detective inspectors, of you know, good and bad choices, what we make, and you know what determines our fates, how large a role should our upbringing and the circumstances we fall into. It's more of that kind of noir tradition of investigating the morality of individuals, I think.
There's a noir tradition, and then I think both sort of narratively and visually there's also a fairly healthy dose of the sort of 70s paranoid thriller in there as well, because of course we haven't really said this, but maybe it's obvious, but a large part of the sort of specific mechanics of the plot involve the fact that the police are trying to find out who the mole is among them, while the triads are trying to do exactly the same thing among their own troops. So there's something of the flavour of, you know, the conversation or something. I mean, it's not really there, you know, those two are extremely different films, but there's something of, like, you know, even down to that sort of the way that both of them do noir in colour and mostly in daylight. I think there are parallels there, right? How you get that sense of fear and paranoia and untrustworthiness, but it's not actually done for the most part. I mean, obviously there are plenty of scenes that happen at night, but it's often actually done with this kind of, I was going to say slightly drab colour scheme, but that's not quite right, because you do have lots of sort of, I don't know, panoramic shots of Hong Kong in broad daylight, but there's something, or it's almost flat, maybe, you know, you get expanses of colour, which you can't quite read, you know, they're just kind of big areas of grey or blue.
Yes, I guess, it's an important part of the film style, which I haven't thought much about, even though it's, you know, the nighttime sequences do evoke that kind of, yeah, tradition. I hadn't thought so much about the fact that daylight features so prominently, and there are even, you know, specific references to Andy Lau being afraid of the light, or his character being afraid of the light, because, you know, he's someone who has had to live this, you know, fake identity, but is someone that, conventionally speaking, is the bad guy.
So
this is a line that Tony Leung delivers to make him feel bad, basically.
Yeah.
As part of this sort of set piece exchanges that we have, it's the color and shape in this film, I think, is probably worth thinking about a bit more. The film is quite, I think it's quite interested in kind of flattening space at times, so as to kind of make you feel that this kind of story does have this kind of larger backdrop, or that maybe there is something kind of weird or like flawed about the setting, because I think Hong Kong is an international kind of iconic, you know, city, and it has a really recognizable skyline in that, you know, harbor. So trying to make that unfamiliar is sort of a challenge, if you like, for the film.
Yes.
If it wants to convey this idea of hiding places and, you know, visually make that theme of, you know, hiding and whatever, quite literally.
I like this flattening space, and it relates to all the, you know, the use of so many windows, which are sometimes transparent and sometimes reflective. But it's more of a, I don't know. Yes, like I hadn't really. I'm just sort of thinking aloud about this, but there's a sense. So rather than a more sort of literally noir style, which is like, okay, there are shadows everywhere, so there could be something sort of lurking in every shadow. In this, it's more the sense of either there's nowhere to hide, because you said there are these expanses, or you don't know where to look for what you're looking for, because it might be a reflection, so you don't even... You know, this sort of invokes the idea of, you know, Hall of Mirrors. I mean, you know, there's no literal scene that kind of does anything like the, you know, Lady from Shanghai. Although there are... Mm. Yeah, actually, there is something I think we're going to talk about when we come to our scene, our specific scene later, the scene on the roof, and actually that kind of plays with these themes. So maybe that will sort of connect up later. But... And I suppose also sort of what it does, or what the premise lets, what the premise facilitates, is that in all these cases you have access to both sides. So you have access to, you know, the person who's trying to find someone. I mean, either sort of, you know, like literally find someone, or, you know, trying to find out who the mole is. But then you also have the person who is trying not to be found. And one sort of sympathies, the way it sort of works, are fairly evenly distributed. You know, the film sort of, it works quite carefully not to, you know, to have these double protagonists. So at any point, that sort of, yeah, the visual style works to amplify the sense that it's both hard to find who you're looking for, because you don't even know where you look for them, but also the sort of, the brightness and the openness gives the sense of the person who's being looked for doesn't have anywhere to hide. You know, there isn't a sort of corner for them to kind of, you know, crawl into and Yeah, and that's all quite effective. We should probably say what, I can't remember it verbatim, but this clip, the quote which the film opens with, you know, it kind of comes up on the screen and then it comes up at the end, is about one particular form of Buddhist hell, which is called continuous hell, I think, which is just sort of, you know, endless suffering. So, which is kind of where one of the characters ends up, I suppose. That's one of the ideas. But we don't avoid spoilers, do we? But I guess we don't need gratuitous spoilers. But that almost, yeah, it's interesting how that connects with the Hong Kong themes, because that almost makes it seem quite apolitical. And it's true that, or not primarily interested in politics.
I think the film has some useful, I'm going to call them like little portals, or the epigraph at the opening and the fact that there is a character adapting the film that we are seeing as we are seeing it, make you think about, other ways of reading what's going on, other frames for analysis, basically, whereas... Yeah, little portals into like other ways of understanding the events. Whereas I think I haven't seen it for ages. That The Departed maybe a bit more direct. I know that they amped up the violence. The Departed in the UK at least was released as an 18, whereas Infernal Affairs was a 15. And I think the Infernal Affairs makes you probably does more with sort of dialogue and interaction at that level rather than the bloody violence and drugs and that kind of...
I think it also just maybe does more with, with things like people's faces. You know, there doesn't always have to be a lot of capital A acting going on, which there tends to be in the Scorsese. I think this really makes makes a lot out of. It's also very good. We haven't sort of. Maybe this hasn't kind of come across at all, but for all that it is about, that it has these double protagonists, it's a great ensemble cast as well. There is a sense in which somehow it doesn't feel straightforwardly like two stars and then a bunch of background characters. There's a more, I suppose there are structural things to do with the police inspector and the triad boss are also doubled the characters, but for my money that it's Eric Tsang, isn't it, who plays Sam, who's the triad boss. I think he's one of the best things about the film.
Embroiled in media sort of sexual assault sort of related not in favour after the film is released, but is a consistent kind of figure in Hong Kong cinema running up to this film and after he's a big personality, isn't he, with that dyed blonde hair, and he's bloody terrifying in the right way, reckons himself a bit of a sort of philosopher, which is nothing scarier than a criminal who thinks and has a worldview, right?
And it's a great, it's a very sort of big performance in the moments when it needs to be, but he also has an excellent line on that way of being terrifying by being silent or by, just looking at somebody. I think one of the things that I think is actually most successful is the sense of Tony Leung's uncertainty as to whether Sam, his boss, is suspecting him of being the mole or not. It's actually impossible to tell, and I think it's impossible for the character to tell, but also impossible for the viewer to tell. And actually the way the scenes between them play out and that sort of tension there is done rather elegantly, actually. It's sort of, understated is the wrong word, but there will be other ways of doing it which would be much more overblown, and this kind of gets it just through. Yeah, Sam will just look at him and, you know, won't say anything, and then he'll hand him a whiskey, and you know, yeah.
That's the other great standoff, isn't it, between the chief, police chief, and the triad leader. Those two have a kind of, you know, if you were to compare it with maybe Andy Lau and Tony Leung, they also have a kind of history and share, you know, equal distribution of drama for both, isn't it, often?
Feel. And another thing that I've been a bit... I find the music quite fun, but I can't help but go, this is kind of naff. But I suppose sort of one of the other real achievements of the film is, for me at least, is that with the occasional exception, it maintains a real momentum, you know, without being actually sort of noisy and crashing and banging for much of the time. But it's also neither is it a real sort of slow procedural kind of film, but it sort of has aspects of both of those, but they don't, the sort of, you know, what I believe people call the beats of the film narrative, they're not, it doesn't hit them in the ways that you, or in quite the ways that you might expect. So it is quite a consistently engrossing experience, I think.
I think the film's really economical in terms of,
right,
it will cram in all sorts of editing effects whenever it can to often, I think, emphasize the thrill of the chase. I think that is what interests the film on a stylistic level most of all, actually, discovery and seeking information in a fast-paced city, I think, is what drives a lot of those choices. I'm thinking in particular about those kind of sped up shots with the freeze frames in black and white of the police chief, you know, on the tail of these criminals. There's a lot of that kind of thing. Actually, if you slow the film down a bit and start to unpick it, there's myriad techniques to discuss, yeah. You know, and I think that in itself has been, you know, the storyline and the kind of the genre kind of context aside, the, just on a technical level, what they're doing has been quite significant. And
I mean, again, I think sort of some of that stuff is maybe not dated as well as some other aspects of the film, but I guess your mileage may vary as people. I don't know, it's a question of balance. I feel maybe some of those sequences are extended a little bit, or they... I mean, it's always interesting with a film like this, which is clearly part of the pleasure, is that it's somewhat confusing, and that's... But... Which at which point the film decides to underline its, you know, to explain things actually quite elaborately, and at which point it's happy to you know, not do that and take the risk that you'll be a bit confused. Yeah, if one was to analyse the film more closely, it might be quite interesting to actually look further at the points at which it makes those choices. But I suppose thinking about that, it would perhaps absolutely support what you were saying earlier about the real interest being in the sort of psychology and the ethical things, because there are, I'm just thinking about, you know, the things that it does underline with these sort of montage sequences tend to be things like sort of going, you know, looking back to the yeah, if you can hear the cat squawking off mic, I should apologise for him. You know, looking back to when they were young men and that sort of history, but the moments when it's happy to leave you being confused are things like exactly what's... I mean, there's a great sequence earlier on when the two when there's a drug deal going on, but the triads are being, you know, are being bugged, and so there's surveillance by the police, and each side, the mole is trying to undercut what their own team is doing, and exactly what's going on there, and who exactly is doing what with whichever radio frequency. It's quite hard well, it's quite hard for me at least to follow exactly what's going on, but it's not of the greatest importance, right? The what you need to follow is that there's someone trying to undermine each side, and it's that sort of that mood of tension and paranoia is what's most important.
I think what the film does quite cleverly in that sequence you're describing, where they've got the wire on Tony Leung and they're eavesdropping, is their editing. So even if you don't understand the mechanics of how they're listening in and communicating and feeding back, the cutting between the two scenarios, the police hideout and the criminal meeting, makes you understand that in this networked culture, you know, this technologically enabled culture, the characters have quite detailed knowledge of certain characters, at least, have quite detailed knowledge of what's happening elsewhere. But equally, others can be entirely detached and ignorant of what's going on. Yes. So it's a lot of it is to do with the faces and from who do you cut to who, you know. And,
right. It's probably also, you just saying that now just makes me think sort of perhaps it's worth sort of a real achievement of the film, which perhaps is easy to miss, is the extent to which it must have been a risk to make the parallels far too pat, you know, to have, right, you know, that there must be a risk when you've got this sort of theme of doubling that runs through the entire film to sort of, you know, match off incidents from, okay, here's what happens to this guy, you know, who's infiltrated the police, and here's the corresponding whatever, moment of threat or corresponding dilemma to the other guy who's infiltrated the triad, but in fact it avoids that, I think, doesn't it? I don't think it's not my experience watching the film. I go, okay, that's a bit of a clunky parallel. It's actually quite deft in how it avoids what I think, you know, must be a screenwriting pitfall at the outset, right? But also an editing pitfall.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does. Yeah. It maintains the characters, I think, as wholes, you know, and as individuals, they have different solutions to the problems that they face. I think also what works in the film's favour is the scope, maybe, that you seeing the setup in the police academy, and
Do you mean scope as in? do you mean the aspect ratio, or do you mean the scope? I mean, because it is a scope film, right?
It is a scope film. I mean, scope. I mean, I think it is a beautiful widescreen movie. I mean, there's all sorts of things, you know, to say about that. But more like, the narrative scope, the timeline,
right?
And seeing how their paths diverge. And I don't think the film entirely absolves them of responsibility either, because they just, as I say, I think it does maintain them as sort of complex individuals. Yeah. And it actually, you know, quite difficult to make parallels in many ways. But it would have been a bad move, and a potential move would have been to do that. Yeah. I think the film is interested in presenting you with a question, like, are there any parallels between these two individuals, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, just thinking about some of the staging and some of the kind of parallel montage and that kind of thing. But I don't think it's necessarily encouraging you one way or the other.
No.
Shall we have a look at a clip?
That's a good idea. Let's do that.
For the listener, I mean, if you'd like to join us, we're going to watch a sequence from the film that I think is part of the reason, really, the film is probably remembered, is where Teddy Leung calls Andy Lau and wants to meet up and sort of get his identity back, essentially, because the two, although are very different, have become sort of codependent. And so they will have a confrontation on a rooftop, which, as we described earlier, is ironically kind of out in the open, but that is somewhere where they can, meet. Maybe we could talk a bit more about the irony
Yeah.
Is there anything else to say about this sequence, you think, Dominic?
It's the confrontation between the two of them, and we may, yeah, perhaps the specifics of the narrative situation are not the most important thing, but that it is a kind of, it's a set piece, isn't it? I mean, it's not the moment at which they meet for the first time. That's already happened, but it's a particularly intense confrontation because the fate of each character is hinging on what only the other one knows at this point, really. So that's, yeah. Yes. So it's a sort of heightened moment of drama.
I will pause the recording and we'll return in a moment. The movement in this sequence, and I'm thinking particularly about when Andy Lau arrives at the rooftop, is quite nicely directed and choreographed, and I've not noticed before really, but there's a nice kind of switching between movements from the right to the left of the screen and then in reverse again, so you have a figure crossing the screen in a kind of long shot and then pausing and then turning, and then a gun comes in from the right of the screen, and there's this kind of back and forth, and it's done not in slow motion as such, but it feels sort of slowed down, so you really notice these emphatic sort of movements. And the shot scales are quite gracefully, although they're dramatically very different, quite gracefully moved between, you know.
There's an interestingly, I was going to say counterintuitive. I think counterintuitive isn't quite what I mean. There's a sort of deceptive quality. So if one is, or it seems to me that there is, that it's much more, both in terms of the cinematography and the, you know, the movement of the camera and the pulling of focus and everything, it's much busier than it feels. You know, in fact, there's something strange, or there's some device happening in it at almost every single moment. But because it also has those sort of expanses of color that we were talking about earlier, it wouldn't be completely crazy to, I mean, it would be entirely wrong, but I could sort of imagine myself almost remembering it as composed of much longer takes than it actually is, or, you know, this is linked to the narrative situation, but it's got a strangely sort of quiet kind of tension somehow, the situation between the two of them, you know, which is involved that, like, you know, they're not literally yelling at each other, but there's kind of, it's underpinned by what we know is at stake. And yeah, because you have these wide shots in places, I sort of feel that when I'm watching it and actually sort of making a deliberate mental note of everything that's going on, I'm surprised by how almost fidgety the stylistic decisions are, because that's not my memory of the experience of it while watching it in context in the film.
One thing that occurred to me, Dominic, I've not watched it before, but, you know, when they, presumably Andy Lau's character now by this point knows very well how police investigations work, and he's got pretty specialist knowledge there, and Tony Leung's knowledge might be a little bit outdated.
Right.
I'm wondering whether Andy Lau, you know, when he's arriving on the rooftop, is actually looking for police presence, or maybe, you know, that if they're overlooking them, you know, in another building, maybe this is a setup to, you know, to arrest him somehow, and he's not quite sure of that. But what the film does quite usefully with that reflective window is that he isn't able to see into those other buildings around. He just has to look back at himself.
No, that's a great point. That's really important. Yeah. So the glass is also opaque. Yes. I mean, it is. It's mirroring, isn't it? You can't. Yeah. And it doesn't. But that's true, actually. No, I hadn't thought at all I was going to say that it doesn't give you a sense of being surveilled, you know. But then, having said it, I think perhaps that's not quite right. I mean, I think it is true that the primary sense is they're kind of alone, you know, up here on top, and yeah, you know, all that the windows do is reflect them back at themselves. But then, actually, if one then thinks about the fact that there could well be people, you know, behind that glass looking at them, that would make a lot of sense, and that I think one could, yeah, just add that in, you know, to one's experience of the scene. Are there things to say about the narration of the scene? Because it sort of starts with more, you know, when, I mean, the sequence which we just watched, when Tony Leung is on that same roof, but is phoning Andy Lau, and that's stylistically quite different. There's a slower, quite sort of elegant, big camera movement, but it is in, you know, there's some sort of stylistic change when Andy Lau gets to the roof and he's anticipating the confrontation and the confrontation itself, which obviously makes sense that there would be a stylistic change, because the
by the narration do you mean
by narration, I mean
narration, how, kind of, you don't mean the voiceover necessarily.
No.
How the film tells its story.
I mean how the film tells its story, and what sort of position we as spectators are taking up, in, you know, towards these stylistic things. So, you know, if it's, let's say, I don't know, you know, Hitchcock uses lots of these specific techniques, although not in this kind of pace or this way. And with Hitchcock, perhaps one tends to have the sense that that somehow Hitchcock, or, you know, the film knows more about what's going on than we do, say. I mean, that's a sort of enormous generalization. But, you know, something like that, I'm not quite sure what sort of comparable, you know, description I would want to use about this, because something like I just said, I don't think I would want to say about this. I don't sort of feel that the film is sort of letting us know that it's telling its story and that it has won over on us. I feel perhaps it's more immersing us in it's sort of expressive in the sense of sort of expressionistic, as in immersing us in the experience of the characters. Perhaps that's more at the forefront.
Yeah.
Maybe the sort of contrast with Hitchcock that I made, even though this is in many ways very different, is perhaps not quite right, because Hitchcock is sort of perhaps slightly even sort of adjusted by being, you know, quite rightly so studied, you know. I think you need to remember why it used to make sense that a lot of people thought it was very peculiar to study Hitchcock as a great film artist, and that people thought it was obvious that was a sort of inappropriate investigation. Perhaps that actually has something to do with what's going on here, you know, that the devices are so much in service of the suspense and the tension, that it's perhaps easy to dismiss, if you're inclined to say, you know, well, the point is, you know, it's just a thriller, get over yourself, you know. And it's big.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, adding more to the list of things to do will be to think through some of the, we mentioned the kind of widescreen aesthetics, to think through where it sits on that cut continuum as well, and maybe
well, that's your territory.
Literally, in terms of, you know, widescreen space, you know, I think it occupies really interesting territory, and that I think I need to think through prominence and significance as well. Mm. So some of the effects that may not have come to light include things like kind of anamorphic distortion. There's a bit of that in the film,
yeah,
as well as things that I think Hitchcock was quite good at in a tighter aspect ratio, which is kind of showing you a lot but not very much at all, to kind of keep you keep you watching. And then there's the difficulties of this location, you know, as a widescreen movie.
Yeah.
In the genre that it is, you know, operating in. So there's a lot to.
Yeah, there's probably lots
of different.
There's probably something we should probably draw to a close. But yeah, that makes me think there probably are things also to do with the Hong Kong's relation to the imagination and its relation to the horizontal and the vertical, because there is a sort of, you know, there's lots of the waterfront space and there is a great sort of horizon, but then of course it's also full of skyscrapers, so the, you know, Hong Kong as a location, or you know, Hong Kong, yeah, seems to actually sort of in itself provide both interesting opportunities but also challenges in terms of widescreen composition, you know. Yeah
absolutely. For now I think it's adieu. And thank you for listening to Discursion. We haven't said our names. My name is Stephen Roberts, and I've also had the great pleasure of co-hosting this episode with... do you want to say your own name?
Yes, my name's Dominic Lash. Yes, thank you for listening, and we'll be back very shortly with another episode, because we're going to record a few in a bit of a clump, so we shall... be able to lay them on you slightly more rapidly than we have done in the past.
And we will be laying them onto you on various streaming platforms. So do subscribe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I should really go and feed this cat whose squawking has been such a feature of this particular episode.